Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to today's Garfunkel Lux Holdco 2SA full year 2016 results call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by the question and answer session. At which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star one on your telephone keypad and wait for your name to be announced. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, 5th of April, 2017. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Colin Storer. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you. Welcome, and a very good afternoon, everybody. My name's Colin Storer. I'm delighted to say I'm the CFO of Garfunkel Holdco 2, and I'm really pleased to welcome you to what's our full year 2016 results call. I'm joined today not only by James Cornell, who you know well as the CEO of our group, but also Claire Johnson and John Trott, who will be on mute today. As you know, they're our highly respected group financial controller and also our head of IR, and I know a number of you will have met them during what was our much-coveted accounting teach-in last month. The success of that session means those who attended should be far better placed to understand our numbers, hopefully. You can certainly test your knowledge by going to www.lauergroup.com to review, download, and indeed analyze both our full year results presentation and also our statutory accounts. Now, before we turn the pages of our full year results presentation, the PowerPoint or PDF document that you may have downloaded already, I need to say that this document captures our full year 2016 consolidated results of what is the consolidated Garfunkel Holdco 2 entity, which for ease, we will now refer to as Lauer. The statutory accounts are fully audited, and we'd like to thank both EY and KPMG for their efforts as we transition towards KPMG being our group auditor for all of our entities. The presentation that we're going to turn the pages on today leverages our audited results, but it also includes some non-IFRS measures such as EBITDA, such as ERC, because we know they aid the understanding of our performance. Now, as at the 31st of December 2015, the ultimate parent company in the group had only been in existence for 7 months. At that point, our group topco had only owned GfK Financial Services GmbH, which we refer to as GfK, for just over 6 months and had owned Metis Bidco for around two and a half months. As such, the comparative figures differ between our statutory accounts and our presentation. In the presentation, we capture the 12 months to December 2015. In other words, we capture the full year pro forma numbers rather than the post-consolidation results, which are what are captured in the statutory accounts. We do this because once again, we think it helps the reader better understand the underlying business and the growth and development of our group. Obviously, the 12 months to December 2016 comprise a full year of trading for both GfK and Metis, and as such, both our presentation and our statutory accounts are drawn from one and the same set of numbers.
Good afternoon, everyone, from me in Munich. Thank you, Colin, and thank you once again for taking the time to join us. If you can just now turn to slide seven, it's a real pleasure for me to open with. 2016 has been a particularly strong year for the group. We delivered a record year of originations. Our NPL acquisitions were up by 23% year-on-year to 306 million pounds, and our 3PC assets under management rose by 29%. We are now managing over 10 billion pounds of face value of debt on behalf of our clients. We also completed two compelling and important acquisitions for the group. Bringing Tesch into the group at the end of Q3 means we have added a highly complementary and attractive standalone asset that helps consolidate our market leadership position in Germany. Extending our reach across the DACH region through the acquisition of AS Inkasso earlier in the year also helped us achieve a market leadership position in Austria. These acquisitions, along with the ongoing sharing of best practices across the regions, are helping us both win new clients and develop ever deeper, ever more embedded, ever more sustainable relationships with our clients. As a final point on the slide, I'm also incredibly pleased to say that today marks the launch of our new group brand, which I'll talk about a bit later. Okay, moving on to slide eight. Colin, of course, will bring alive our financial highlights shortly, However, without wanting to steal his thunder, I would like to draw your attention to our primary focus to once again pleasing double-digit percentage growth across a number of our key metrics. A 30% increase in our 120-month gross ERC, which as at December 2016 now stands at £1.8 billion. A 22% increase in our cash income, and a 20% increase in our cash EBITDA, continuing the unbroken trend we're so proud of, with EBITDA growing now from £212 million to £254 million in 2016. These numbers have been achieved against a backdrop of integration between what were standalone UK and DACH businesses, the success of which means we believe we now have a platform that's extremely well placed to deliver long-term sustainable value creation. Moving on to slide 9. This provides us with a point of reflection as to our success in delivering what we initially set out to do. Our primary focus as an executive team has been to put in place the fundamentals that allow for a strong pan-European platform. Our group management structure is now firmly in place, supported by UK and DACH regional management teams with strength and depth. A number of group functions have been established to give visibility, control, and share best practices across geographies. And our new brand will, of course, further help us unify all of us under a single common identity. The coming together of what was Laul in the UK and GFKL was always intended to give rise to income-led synergies, and a particular highlight for me in 2016 has been our ability to effectively deploy more capital into the DACH region. We've seen our DACH NPL acquisitions increase by 72%, uplifting the quantum of spend from £45 million to £78 million. And we've seen the scale of our 3PC business increase by 30%, driven by organic growth and, of course, the acquisitions of Tesh and IS Incasso. And finally, our four-year plan to realise the more modest synergies around cost reductions remain on track, reflecting our ambition to collect smarter, collect more efficiently and effectively, whilst all the time ensuring an appropriate focus upon client, consumer, and, of course, compliance. Moving on to slide 10. I want to talk to you about data, as we firmly believe we still have a significant competitive advantage in this area. As a group, we've probably the largest data sets in our chosen markets. As you can see, we own over 25 million NPL accounts, and we manage over £10 billion on behalf of others. But what's really important is that we have the decision science capabilities to harness that raw data. We have a team of extremely impressive analysts, modelers, quants, doctors even, that is now some 50 strong. And through their building, development, and refinement of a huge number of models and scorecards, we benefit from ever greater insight into our consumers and their circumstances, allowing us to perpetually refine our consumer interaction and improve both their consumer outcomes and, of course, for us, net present value per account. Our 60% UK consumer crossover means that we, for every new portfolio that we typically match 60% of the accounts to our existing UK back book, an unrivaled advantage that improves our pricing accuracy, increases our portfolio wins, and of course reduces downside risk. It's for this reason that we can call out the increase in the amount of internal collections per customer-facing FTE in the UK over the past 3 years, a perfect example of our advantages to our data. Moving on to slide 11. Before I hand back to Colin, I'd just like to close the section by drawing attention to the visibility and certainty we have now regarding our new business. Once again, we've increased the number of forward flow model arrangements we benefit from. The group now has 47 signed forward flow contracts in place, up 27% from a year ago. And really pleasingly, a number of these contracts are now over longer periods of time. Some of our contract extensions in 2016 saw us agree a five-year term, meaning we have line of sight of now some £310 million of investment purchases over the next 5 years. This visibility means we start 2017 with a high degree of coverage of our ERC maintenance spend, a position that means we are less beholden to closing out one-off or spot-type deals to achieve an ongoing ERC and balance sheet growth. At the same time, we continue to apply a disciplined approach to our portfolio pricing, and as you can see from the charts on the right-hand side of slide 11, our underwriting assumptions have been consistently accurate and marginally prudent. And we finished 2016 having achieved 108% and 105% of our collection assumptions for our 2014 and 2015 vintages, respectively.
I think that's a really important point, James. And I think there's a number of other financial highlights that we'll touch upon in due course. But before we do and get into the detail behind our performance last year, one thing I'd like to do is just maybe preempt some of the questions we typically receive about general market and macroeconomic conditions and maybe just talk through what's on slide 13. Now, we obviously invite everyone to once again appreciate that the markets in which you operate are critically important to your success. We operate in the largest consumer credit markets in Europe. We would, however, like to challenge any misconception that just because we work in markets which have maturity, that somehow equates to a market which has a lack of growth or a lack of growth prospects. In fact, we draw your attention to something which is quite the opposite. We draw your attention to the increasing level of consumer credit origination that's apparent in both the UK and Germany. Now, in the UK particularly, it seems that British consumers are determined to spend their way through Brexit, with much of that spending increasingly on credit. Now, touching on Brexit, in fact, no presentation would be complete without touching on Brexit. Whilst there's clearly uncertainty as to what remains around the outcome, not least because Article 50 has been triggered in the last week or so, we think it's important to not lose sight of the bigger picture in terms of what remains a reasonably benign, a reasonably attractive environment for our customers to fulfil their obligations. Low interest rates, record low levels of unemployment, and low inflation compared to historical precedent. Indeed, without wishing to be overly glass half full, just last month a survey of UK CFOs talked about, and I quote directly, further easing of the Brexit shock that hit corporate spirits last summer, with business optimism at an 18-month high. Now, stepping back from the market update, slide 14 begins the deep dive into our numbers. Now, you can read the narrative as quickly as I can talk through the 5 points which we've captured, but suffice to say, James hasn't stolen my thunder. Suffice to say that actually we're really pleased with the growth across our key metrics, the diversification that the business continues to benefit from, and that aids us not only in terms of growth but providing you with real downside protection, but we're also really pleased with the scale that we're beginning to evolve to. Now, talking about scale, slide 15 allows us to understand a little bit more about our purchasing success. We grew our purchases across both our markets, and we grew it by both double-digit percentages. Within DAC, purchases were 72% higher. They increased from 45 million to 78 million. And in the UK, we also recorded an increase of 12%, taking our purchases in the UK alone to 229 million. And that gives us a total combined spend of some 306 million in the calendar year of 2016. The quantum's impressive, but what's equally impressive is the fact that this spend was spread across 336 individual portfolios. That is diversification in its most simple form. Equally, the quantum of spend in 2016 equates to nearly three times what we would be needing to spend to keep our December ERC forecast flat. That's three times the amount of our maintenance spend for the prior year. Now, our maintenance spend required to keep our December 16 ERC flat is estimated to be some £140 million. This figure is based upon our next 12-month collections, obviously less the roll-forward collections that we benefit from in our tail, and then we divide that by a blended gross money multiple from our recent vintages. Now, that we once again expect to purchase more than our maintenance spend is testament to what we still believe is a unique origination capability. We purchase across sectors. We're not beholden to financial services. We purchase using both auctions and forward flow deals. And ultimately, we purchase from clients we know incredibly well. In fact, in 2016, the percentage of purchases that came from forward flows had grown to 38%, while 81% of our purchases came from existing clients we know and understand. Slide 16 shows our income and our earnings. We recorded a 22% increase in our cash income, seeing the figure grow to £483 million for the 12 months to December 16, and that's up from £394 million for the prior year. Once again, we define cash income in keeping with our previous bond OMs as cash collections from owned assets, plus those fees and commissions that we earn from assets that we service on behalf of others. Now, this increase in cash income is obviously the principal driver of impressive growth in cash EBITDA, and that cash EBITDA on a reported basis now stands at £254 million, and that's up 20% year on year. Importantly, that's a different number to a pro forma calculation, and a pro forma calculation will obviously include a 12-month contribution from Tesh and IS and Castle, and that pro forma calculation, free of any further synergy run rates associated with cost, sees us record a cash EBITDA of £262 million for the 12 months to December 2016. It's also worth reiterating, I think, that cash EBITDA is a lagged measure. It's a lagged metric for two reasons. Firstly, it typically takes around, say, 6 months before purchased assets throw off significant monthly cash flow. And critically, the second point to appreciate is that during that precise period, because the bulk of our purchases are non-performing debt, these first 6 months see a greater proportion of our servicing costs being incurred. We have an upfront cost curve. And that's unsurprising because we need to proactively establish contact with our customers. We need to do that to understand their circumstances, to build a rapport, and to ultimately agree our sustainable long-term payment plans. Consequently, if you step back and think that providing purchases have been made over and above your maintenance spend, the business at any point well, should naturally see a step up in cash EBITDA from the back book because future collections from setup arrangements build whilst at the same time the upfront servicing cost ratio begins to normalise. And it's precisely because of this dynamic that I would point out one important fact, and that's that some 32% of our full year 2016 spend came in just the last 2 months of 2016. Now moving on to our asset backing, and slide 17 shows the continued growth in our estimated remaining collections across both regions. DAC ERC increased by 47% to stand at £0.4 billion, and the UK increased by 25% to come to £1.3 billion, both numbers being 120 months. Now, given that £1.8 billion that we project to collect from existing assets that are already on our balance sheet over the next 120 months, I know that you'll understandably be challenging us as to the accuracy of our ERC forecast. It's a fair question, and it's one which we always wish to be transparent in answering. So I direct you to the top right-hand quadrant of slide 17, where you can see from that chart an expectation of total collections against the ERC projection going into any given period. And here, our collections have consistently proven to be both accurate and indeed prudent. If I take the most recent year, for example, 2016, we collected 104% of our closing balance ERC projection as at December 15 in the next 12 months. Here, I think the front-loaded nature of our collections means that we do benefit from a lower collection risk and higher forecasting accuracy. Nearly 40% of our 120-month gross ERC crystallizes as cash collections in the immediate 24 months, meaning we expect to collect in excess of £680 million of that ERC balance over the next 2 years alone. And whilst our ERC evolution is impressive, it clearly needs context. And slide 18 hopefully does that because it draws out our ERC against the levels of our debt and then also, just as importantly, against the levels of our leverage as at the 31st of December 2016. I'm sure you'll note the improvement in the group's leverage from the position as at the last bond issuance, and that's despite a record quarter of investments. We actually invested £110 million in Q4, which is probably up against market expectation, and that actually comes hot on the heels of having invested £82 million in non-performing acquisitions in Q3. And yet against that backdrop, our net debt to EBITDA still improved from 5.1 to 4.9 times. Now, this is a leverage level that I'm comfortable with. It's also a leverage level that we think we can improve further, and we expect over the medium term to achieve a like-for-like leverage in the region of 4 to 4.5 times. As at the 31st of December 16, the absolute quantum of the group's net debt stood at £1.281 billion. That's a small increase from the last quarter, and that reflects our RCF having been utilized to fund that recent purchasing success that I've just called out. We obviously remain well-placed to fund future purchases from our existing capital structure. We've got an available undrawn RCF of $95 million at year-end, and that's accompanied with a cash balance of £98 million that's obviously held on balance sheet at the same date. That said, and as you'd expect, we remain highly rational in considering our funding options and our funding strategy, and we note the receptiveness of the high-yield markets to recent issuances by similarly rated issuers in Europe. I think, again, another important point to call out is the lagged nature of a net debt to adjusted EBITDA measure. Actually, the ERC to net debt ratio, while more appropriate to just a pure play debt purchase, is nevertheless insightful because it's a more immediate ratio in reflecting the upside in a period of purchasing success. And here, our year-end ERC to net debt leverage was 70%, and that is significantly down from the 79% that was shown in our September 2016 offering memorandum. Stepping away from the financials and just covering off regulation, disappointingly, we're not yet able to confirm the authorization of our FC application, as you can see on slide 20. This remains pending, although we believe that the FCA's internal governance is gathering pace. We, like you, look forward to being able to communicate further progress in due course. We also note that the final version of the EU General Data Protection Regulation has been agreed and published, and that there's an implementation which is due in 2018. We foresee no issues given our ongoing investments in our infrastructure that's intended to ensure data security, compliance with regulation, and indeed the ongoing need to continue to protect both the reputation of the group but also of our clients. We also continue to benefit from active employment in key regulatory matters across all of our core markets, given that we have representation upon the key participation bodies in both Germany and the UK. We participate in Germany in terms of the BDIU, which is the National Association of Debt Collection Agencies, and we, of course, continue to lead the Credit Services Association in the UK, and that supports our ability to remain at the forefront of industry practice. And finally, without wishing to be something of a tease, we're delighted to reveal that just last week we've retained our exceptional rating from investor and customers, and that's also come with some incredible news on our net promoter scores, but I am going to tease you a little and say that we're going to refer more to that in our Q1 presentation, which follows hot on the heels of this, given that it will be delivered within 2 months of our annual results call.
Thanks, Colin. And if everybody can just turn to slides 22 and 23, and I'll just talk about our new group brand. So just over a year on from the merger of our two businesses back in October 2015, we think it's now time to galvanize our people, our consumers, and our clients under our new shared group brand and identity, Lau. The Lau brand has proven equity and existing strong positive associations. It's also already familiar and respected by our stakeholders, and within our new brand identity and logo embodying the concept of moving forwards with designs, imagery, and language that reflects our positive direction, we believe it's as appropriate for the group tomorrow as it has been in the UK for the past 12 years. We exist to improve the financial well-being of our clients and consumers, and we do this with a principled approach and pioneering consumer insight. We have a clear vision and strategy, and we believe we offer a positive, forward-looking message to all our stakeholders and interested parties. And so to concluding remarks on slide 24. 2016 has been a fantastic year for the group, but of course we look forward to 2017 and beyond with ever greater enthusiasm. Our focus on building platforms with sustainable competitive advantages in the right markets remains central to who we are and what we do. Our disciplined approach to pricing and investment is at the centre of our DNA. We will seek to continue to grow, but our focus upon generating acceptable returns remains. We are building for the long term. And finally, we have seen a strong start to 2017. Our first 2 months trading has been very pleasing, and we look forward to updating you on the entirety of our first quarter on the next call scheduled for the 23rd of May. We'd like to thank you for all listening, and without further ado, can I ask the operator to open up the lines for any questions you may have?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. As a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad and wait for your name to be announced. The first question comes from the line of Alexander Grun. Please ask your question.
Good afternoon. I have a couple of questions on your costs. I think you mentioned the other operating expenses, which are up about 20 million relative to last year. What's been the driver of this increase? Is this a one-off? It seems up, and you mentioned it in the last 2 months. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? And then secondly, maybe just to follow up with regards to the pending FCA approval, is there something where we should look for maybe some slight change in the cost structure, i.e. do you have to do some amendments, or is everything going to remain the same?
Thanks, Alexander. So let me pick off both questions, if I may. So in terms of our operating expenditure, I think the actual numbers that we included within GH2 in the stat accounts was 348 million against a prior year of 276. So hopefully that just clarifies the numbers that you're referring to. That represents a growth in OPEX of around 26%. At the same time, we've seen a growth in our revenue of a comparable number. But I think what's included within the operating expenses is a couple of different dynamics. The first is it reflects the book growth. So actually, the total number of accounts that we own has grown by circa 20%. So obviously, with that increase in the number of accounts, we incur an awful lot of collection costs up front within that period. And we've also had some exceptionals in that period as well, such as the write-down of our GFKL trademark within the period, which is a 6 million one-off non-recurring cost. And then I think the other point to pull out is clearly we have had the acquisition and integration of Tesh and IS, which does increase our headcount cost a little bit, but obviously we get the income and the earnings which come from those acquisitions as well.
Well, and the only other point I would probably add as well on the second question is, you know, clearly we've been operating under the FCA since April 2014, so clearly we've been incurring increased costs from business for some time. And I think, of course, this is one of the main reasons that's been driving a lot of the consolidation in the market, where, you know, players of efficiency of scale clearly benefit from.
Okay, thank you. Maybe just a very quick one, then others can jump in. In terms of deleveraging your targets, what sort of drivers have you identified to reach that target? Is it cost savings? Is it increase in servicing? If you can elaborate a little bit how you get to that number, that would be quite helpful. Please.
Yeah, by all means, I'd be delighted to. So to clarify, cost-saving plays a part. Clearly, as a bigger business and with a greater proportion of our assets, which come from the back book rather than new acquisitions, our cost-to-collect ratio should improve over time. But I think what's really important for us is we've tried to show historically how this is a business which throws off significant free cash flow, significant excess cash above and beyond the average replenishment rate. And we don't intend to pay down debt and improve our leverage that way. Instead, we tend to deploy that capital into attractive further investment opportunities, which on a typical 2x cash on cash multiple obviously allows us to grow our EBITDA. And with the growth in that EBITDA, we're then able to achieve the deleveraging that we anticipate and expect on a like-for-like basis.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Alexander.
Thank you. The next question comes from the line of Sunny Chabra. Please ask your question.
Hello, hi. Thanks for taking my questions. Just to follow up on the previous question on your medium-term leverage expectations, just to clarify that the 4 to 4.5 times leverage is for the total net debt, right?
Correct. That's a net debt to EBITDA ratio.
Okay, and regarding the timeline, when you say medium-term expectation, can you give some indication about by medium-term, do you mean more like a year or 2 years, or how are you thinking about that?
I mean medium-term in the typical sense. So I'm not anticipating that we'll achieve that within 6 months, but I think it's realistic to expect that we'll achieve that in the medium term, something over a year to a year and a half.
Got it. Secondly, regarding the cash EBITDA and the collection income of GFKL for the full year, is it possible for you to split it in among the DP and the 3PC business? For example, if you show 176 million of collection income for GFKL business, is it possible for you to give me the DP and the 3PC split?
In an answer, no. So what we try and do is we think about segmental reporting, and we think about the contribution of DP and 3PC in terms of cash income rather than cash EBITDA. So about 20% of our cash income comes from 3PC. The remainder obviously comes from DP. The reason why we don't give out that split to a cash EBITDA level is because certainly in Germany we have an integrated business, which has the same servicing platform, which looks after both debt purchase and also 3PC. And therefore, the allocation of costs becomes something of an academic exercise, and it's just not something that we focused on as a result.
Got it. Thank you. Last one, in one of your recent presentations, you mentioned that you're seeing some signs that the banks are likely to increase the volume of NPL sales. Can you give a little bit of more color on that, maybe a little bit more elaboration about, are you talking about the UK region or the German region there?
Yeah, so I'll pick that up. So I think it's fair to say that pipelines both in the DACH region and in the UK are very plentiful. So we're seeing a lot of activity in both regions. I think it's fair to say there have been some banks, specifically in the UK, that have been more hesitant in selling in the last few years due to a lot of restructuring and things going on internally within their own corporations. And we've seen activity be rejuvenated very recently. So, as I said, I'm very pleased with the dynamics of what's going on in the market.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from the line of Tao Pan. Please ask your question.
Hey, hi. I just have two questions, and they are a bit related. Earlier, you mentioned about the after Brexit, you still see benign environment. But how if inflation gets even higher, and then you start to see like people losing jobs and stuff, and will this affect your ERC, like the collection projections? As you have seen, you have shown in the past, you have been quite disciplined, and the projections are quite accurate, but do you see this deterioration in macro picture affect that projection?
Okay, thank you for that question. It's one which is a fairly common question to us, so let me answer it in a couple of different ways. So I think that any uptick in inflation or any increase in employment is unlikely to happen overnight. I think that if base rate starts to rise, it is likely to be a pretty slow response to an increasingly inflationary environment. So if interest rates do go up, if inflation does go up, and if unemployment does go up, then I think you can take a degree of comfort in the fact that we have such a front-loaded collection curve. I'd refer you back to the previous point I made as to the proportion of our ERC curve, which comes back within 24 months, because by the time that macroeconomic Armageddon hits us that you've just referred to, I would expect us to have collected a significant proportion of our ERC, which is real downside protection. I think the second point which I would call out is the fact that in any given quarter, around 78% of the UK's collections come from repayment plans. They are not one-off in nature. These are long-term sustainable payment plans, which are derived only after a very robust assessment of a household's ability to repay. We stress test customers' ability to repay, and as a result, we set up plans which people can stick to. The third point, which I would then say, is the validation of that claim, which is what happened during the last recession, where I know that we are one of the few businesses globally who can show that we outperformed a static pool in terms of the UK. So I know that if I look at 2008 and our ERC projections going into that, we outperformed the curve during the recession and continued to outperform thereafter.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question comes from the line of Laura Koenigswald. Please ask your question.
Thank you. So I have two questions, please. The first question would be about the valuation of your 3PC business. I understand that it's hard for you to provide with us with an estimation of the EBITDA contribution. But do you have could you kind of value this kind of business, because it obviously adds to your ERC estimate, and it would probably provide us a better estimate of your LTV at the company level. And the second question would be, there has been a recent increase in the difference of your financing costs with Cabot on one side and Arrow on the other side, which and I think the fact that Arrow is listed and that Cabot had made public its plans to be listed have significantly improved the financing plan. So to the extent that it's relatively medium to long term private equity plan that you're in, do you plan being listed at a minority level at some stage?
Okay, thank you. I think there's probably three different questions in there, so allow me to paraphrase so that I can make sure I answer them correctly.
Sure.
I think you talked about valuation of 3PC. You talked about our financing costs, and I wish to elicit a degree of comment upon the financing cost of others. And then lastly, our long-term equity prospects. Is that the...
Yeah, and how far this an IPO, a partial IPO, could help your plans?
Okay, I'll pick off all three, and I'm sure James will probably wish to jump in. So in terms of the valuation of the 3PC business, I'm afraid that's something which I'm going to struggle to be able to help you with. I mean, clearly we're very focused upon growing our 3PC business, but because of the limitations of being able to calculate a 3PC contribution to EBITDA, it's not something that we ever step back and say, how would we value the 3PC business on a standalone basis? It's intrinsic to who we are and what we do, particularly in Germany. In terms of financing costs, we were delighted to see that Arrow has both been re-rated. We think that's a positive for the sector, and we were delighted to see the receptiveness of the high-yield markets to Arrow, both in terms of the coupon that they benefited from and also the tenor of the issuance that they got out there. Clearly, there is others who've also had similar success, and we were pleased with the evolution of our overall debt issuance coupons when we went to the market and got the most recent FRN euro out. But clearly we're very rational. We consider all of our funding optionality. We'll continue to do so. We're certainly mindful of call dates and when they come up, and equally mindful of making sure that we make the right decisions in the right market at the right time. The last point around what that might mean in terms of IPO and exit, I would stress that Permira, still only a year into their investment, they're very pleased with how the business is going. They see the potential for the business to grow ever further. You know, they are private equity, and at some juncture, I'm sure they will consider what their exit plans are. An IPO may well be the logical conclusion for us, but all we're focused upon at the moment is making sure that we build a business not just for today, not just for an exit, but a sustainable business for the long term.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from the line of Michael Roper. Please ask your question.
Hi, thanks for the call. I had three questions. One, can you just help me on the 120 minus ERC bridge? If you take the open and add the portfolio acquisitions at the gross money multiple plus the roll from 132 and then net cash collections, there still seems to be a kind of 170 million unaccounted for to get to your closing. I'm presuming a lot of this is FX, but if you could just provide any guidance here, that would be great. The second one is just around this whole 2x gross money multiple. It's not that instructive. I know everybody discloses it, but it doesn't tell us anything about, your mix and IRRs. So any word on, competitive landscape, how that 2x gross money multiple used in your replenishment rate reflects, your when you look forward, your mix between performing, non-performing, and any comment on what it means on a kind of IRR basis. And then finally, just that 8 million you add back to get to cash EBITDA, for an impairment on the purchase portfolios, what P&L line item does that go through? Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Some meaty questions in there, so let me try and pick them off individually. And I know James will want to give a view in terms of the competitiveness of the environment. Clearly, you've looked at 120-month roll forward. It's difficult for me to see exactly the roll which you refer to. The one thing which I would say is that our ERC and particularly our closing balance, which is obviously the discounted ERC at year end, is subject to huge scrutiny from the auditors. We are very confident that the ERC is robust, but without seeing the actual roll forward that you refer to, it's kind of difficult for me to calculate. I think you're approaching it conceptually the right way, which is, you know, we've got $306 million on a two times cash on cash, gets you around $700 million worth of purchases. You take off the collections that we successfully achieved in the course of 2016 of circa $400 million. You've then got revaluation. And I think it's probably the revaluation is the number which you're missing rather than thinking that it's all FX. And then that gets you back to that $1.765 billion. So, you know, I'm more than happy to try and pull out a more educated walk maybe on our subsequent Q1 numbers, but at a high level, that's how that works. In terms of the gross money multiples, I can only apologize if what we're producing is not insightful. We're clearly challenging ourselves to think about how best to maintain the lead in terms of transparency and openness. And I know that we've captured on slide 27 a view of our gross money multiples. And I think the important thing for me is that, you know, we shouldn't equate IRRs to gross money multiples. They are two different things. Clearly, we don't disclose our IRRs, nor does anyone in the marketplace. There's commercial sensitivity to both us and our clients. Having said that, clearly we've put down what our blended gross money multiple is. And you are quite right, Michael, to say that the blend within there is obviously key. So I would hate anyone to think that the relative decline in gross money multiples from two times in the UK in 2014 to 1.8 times in terms of 2016 in terms of what we've priced is down to pricing pressure. It's not. It's down to mix. So we've seen a slight increase in the proportion of our paying debt during that period. And our paying debt obviously has a lower cash-on-cash multiple. It also comes with lower risk, and it also comes with a lower cost-to-collect ratio. So again, it would be erroneous for people to think that actually paying debt has a materially lower actual return. I think the other point to call out is clearly people look at 2016 and try and make judgment to the past. I've explained the mix effect. But one other important dynamic to consider is that we've got a track record of consistently outperforming our gross money multiples at pricing. The business constantly innovates and as a result is able to generate cash on cash in addition to our underwriting expectation. Now, clearly in terms of 2016, it's a relatively youthful vintage. In fact, I'd go further than that. It's a very immature vintage, given that 30% of it was purchased in the last 2 months of the year. We've not had a chance to outshine that underwriting expectation, but already the initial signs are very positive, and that's why our actual gross money multiple on the 2016 vintage is already a notch higher despite that purchasing dynamic. I think your last point was around market conditions. James, I don't know if you wish to make a comment upon market conditions in the UK further to what you have to date.
Yeah, so look, I think to echo a lot of Colin's comments, to be honest, so I think that realistically, you know, we're seeing, you know, a relatively mature market being pretty consistent in its pricing dynamics. Of course, you know, and to be honest, I've seen this in the last 14 years, there's always been pockets of ill discipline, which is why we constantly talk about our very consistent, disciplined approach and our returns as well as our continued outperformance consistently on our pricing expectations sort of mirrors that. And clearly, by the virtue of the fact that we've been able to grow our acquisitions by such an impressive track record once again, demonstrates, you know, we're happy with how the market is progressing. So.
Great. Yeah, and the gross money multiple, it's not a criticism. I mean, your disclosure is great. It's just, you know, when you go from, because you have this ability to buy from different types of vendors, and we've seen the gradual fall in gross money multiples, say in the UK, where you've traditionally done a lot of your portfolio acquisitions, even though it's growing in Germany. So when we use 2x as a, I guess, a benchmark for replacement rate, I was just wondering whether that meant, you know, you probably looking forward won't be doing as much performing, or that was where the question was coming from, as opposed to a, because I appreciate no one, you know, your disclosures exactly like the rest of the market.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarity. I mean, I think, you know, clearly the long-term average has been 2x on pricing. Clearly our actual gross money multiples that we have achieved have been consistently higher because of that dynamic of the maturing of the book. I've got every expectation that 2016 will get to 2x as a minimum, and I don't anticipate the purchasing mix to fundamentally change going forward, although obviously I'm mindful of forward-looking statements. But thank you for that, Michael. And Michael, I think I owe you one further answer as well, so apologies in my enthusiasm to talk about gross money multiples. You did ask a question about where the negative revaluation flows through the accounts. So you're quite right to have mentioned that there is a small negative revaluation on in terms of impairment of some of our non-performing loans. It's a figure of 8.9 million. You see that in note 15, most explicitly in the portfolio investments walk on page 41 of the stat accounts, and it flows through in terms of the face of the P&L, both in other expenses and collection cost line.
Great. Thanks, Seb.
No problems.
Thank you. The next question comes from the line of Alexander Nordhagen. Please ask your question.
Hi, James. Hi, Colin. Thanks for the update and congrats on the quarter. I have a couple of questions. One, on the scalability of the business, a bit like Alex Grin to begin with, I'm just wondering where the where you see it coming from, really. The, you know, other operating expenditures are up. Employees grew a lot during the year. I figured that was down to acquisitions. And you don't provide a breakout of your collection activity costs, so I don't really know what to look at there. But could you give me some color on where that scalability comes from?
Yeah, Colin, I'll pick that up for me. So look, I think, again, it's sort of been a consistent story, you know, over the past year. So, yeah, and I guess as the market's maturing, we're seeing a couple of dynamics. One of them is we're seeing further consolidation, and, you know, clearly we've demonstrated our ambitions in that in the past, albeit very tactically. So I think there will be continued consolidation in the markets as it further matures. There is, of course, still trends and forecasts that are suggesting continued organic growth just in volumes. And I think, again, similar in certainly in some of the evolving markets, Germany still being one of those, we're seeing sort of changes in patterns of both more outsourcing, but also in terms of maturity of pricing by virtue of people selling further up the line. So that obviously both brings more volume to the purchasing side, but it also brings higher average prices and so on as well. So those are other things that are driving future growth.
And could you remind me what your synergy target was for GFKL?
So we give guidance that the vast majority of the synergies would be client and top line led. I think we've given guidance that the cost number was a more modest number. It was low single digit, and we are well on track to achieve that.
Okay. And then I just had two more. One's a quick one. On restricted cash, you have 21 million at the end of the year. Is that just collections you've done on behalf of third party that you haven't yet to pass back to them?
Exactly.
Okay, thanks. And then on the finally on the overlap of your clients in the UK, you said what 60% of new accounts, 60% of customers in the new portfolios you buy, you've already got the information on them, and that's a good thing. I understand that angle. But what about the bad side, which is, have you potentially just bought a portfolio that that you're going to collect on a customer that's already maxed out, already paying back debt before that you bought years ago, and they don't actually have the ability to pay it back? You know, are these customers just totally maxed out already, and you've just picked up the last piece of debt they accumulated, and therefore this new portfolio won't be as easy to collect on as the first one, perhaps?
Colin, I'll pick up the more latter point. So I think that obviously by virtue of us having more insight to our consumers, that has to be only a positive, because is a big part of what we do is to set up realistic payment plans, and therefore understanding their net disposable income and their ability to repay their accounts back provides us with a more realistic outlook to their future cash flow ability. And therefore, we're able to adjust our prices accordingly. So it's all relative to what our expectations are to consumers going forward. So having more insight clearly gives us much greater advantages than others. I think the other important factor as well, it also gives us a cost advantage, because clearly a lot of the consumers that we are already working with means that we've already got a lot of the information and insight to be able to understand the consumer circumstances. And quite often the case, we have improved engagement scores by virtue of us already working with those consumers and wanting to help them on a more holistic basis. So it provides, like I said, many advantages.
Okay, I mean, perhaps this could settle it, but how many of the end clients actually are paying back two debts to you at the same time?
Don't have that information to hand. It's something that we track, but we don't have it to hand, and I'd hate to give a false steer.
Okay, that's all right. Thanks. Can I just have you ever disclosed what the terms of the shareholder loan to Permira are?
We've never talked about it on a bond call. It may be in the offering memorandum, and I think it's actually it's disclosed in the staff account. And I think it's note 19. I think has the rate of interest in there, but it's definitely in the stats, so you could have a look there.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad and wait for a name to be announced. Dear speakers, there are no further questions at this time. Please continue.
I'll take that we've bored our listeners rigid in the last hour, and we'll move on. So many thanks to everybody who's dialed in. As ever, we've enjoyed both the Q&A as well as the presentation, and we look forward to joining you once again with our Q1 results presentation at the end of May. Many thanks. Bye now.
Thanks, everyone.
That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect. Have a nice day.